Hello, this is Andre DeShields. I have the pleasure of starring in Robert O'Hara's new play, Mankind, which is having its world premiere at Playwrights Horizons Theatre. Please come check it out. And I also have the pleasure of speaking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Days Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, shalom, my friends. This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon, founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And, oh, if ever a wonder the Wiz there was, the Wiz is with us, ladies and gentlemen. The man who played the original Wiz in The Wiz. A man who was in the original Ain't Misbehavin', for which he was a Drama Desk nominee, and he even played the role on television, which got him an Emmy. Plus, he was a Tony nominee for Play On, and in that wonderful musical, The Full Monty. This man even choreographed the women singing behind Bette Midler back in the day. I am talking about Andre DeShields. He's a Lifetime Achievement honoree from the Obie Awards and the Odelco Awards, and you can see him right now off-Broadway in a show called Mankind at Playwrights Horizons. As a matter of fact, Variety said about his performance, Andre DeShields cuts a strong figure in a number of roles and is especially daunting as a fire and brimstone lawyer. So please welcome the brilliant, the talented, the daunting Andre DeShields to the neighborhood. Shalom to you.
Shalom, Rabbi Saul Solomon. It's such a pleasure to spend my Friday afternoon with you.
Well, it's a pleasure here. Just before Shabbos, which is perfect.
Yes, just before Shabbos. I was wondering if we would get this in time before sundown.
I'm working on it. I'm talking extra fast so that we can make this make this happen. And if I have to launch into Hebrew and Yiddish, I'll do that too. But so you have done so many roles and so much over your career and such diversity in the roles that you play. Let's even start off with one or two of the favorite parts that you've played over your whole career.
Well, the top of that list is The Wiz, the title role in the Broadway musical The Wiz, which opened on January 5th, 1975. It was a game-changing musical because it brought to Broadway for the first time in numbers the black community, which, if we tell the truth, has never found Broadway as an hospitable terrain. But we changed that in 1975. A soulful remake of the L. Frank Baum American fairy tale, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. We all know it as the brilliant movie starring Judy Garland. But when we did The Wiz with Stephanie Mills in the role of Dorothy, it opened the door to all little girls to learn the most important lesson of life, and that is there's no place like home.
And it doesn't matter what shithole you come from. It still is no...
It does not matter what shithole you come from.
So,
now, whom are we quoting? We're quoting the President of these United States.
I know.
Hello. It's a sad day. It's my birthday also, but it's a sad day for America when that's the quote we take from our president.
But first of all, Mazel Miklik, are you now 72 years old?
Today, I mark my 72nd year on the Earth plane.
On the Earth plane, my goodness. So,
yes.
let me ask. Well, let me ask you, Andre DeShields. So, 72, you're known as not just an actor, but a singer and a dancer. Have you had to modify your performance? Do you have to slow down a little bit? Do you have to stretch more or anything than you did 30 years ago, or do you feel still like you're 20 years old?
I'm glad you asked that question, Rabbi, because those of us who want sustainability and longevity in this industry that demands intellectual, emotional, and physical, the best of us, every day, what I've learned is 30, 40, 50 years ago, when my career, my professional career started, I could do everything on adrenaline. 5, 6, 7, 8, hit it. Now that I'm 72, what I've learned wisely is that I can achieve the very same effect with greater economy.
So just, yeah, it's sort of like the Bob Fosse thing. You can just move a pinky instead of your whole arm and glue the audience's eyes to that part rather than having to go through gyrations and everything like that.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly correct. What I used to do with sweat, I now do with sweetness.
Oh, I love the way you put that. What I used to do with sweat, I now do with sweetness. Now tell us something sweet or something nice about the show that you're in. It's called Mankind over at Playwrights.
Mankind, yes.
Yeah, please tell us a little bit about the show and whom you play. You play a few different roles in it.
Yeah, but the sticker, the one that the audience comes away from the show remembering, is a very conservative prosecutor whose name might be Roy Moore, Ohio, or even Donald Trump. The play is a satire. It's a parody that resonates to the current body politic. And the underlying message is feminism is about to rule the world.
Which is a good thing, no?
That's what we posit in the play, but because it's satire, you have to really invest in what we are saying between the lines, because the period in which the play exists is the future. Women have become extinct.
Oh.
Men are now responsible for procreating the race. And through the magic of evolution, men can now carry to full term a child in their womb.
Whoa. Okay, and that's what happens, I think, in the first scene of the play, is a guy gets pregnant from another guy and then has to decide what to do.
Exactly. And the solution by the end of the play is we must revivify, we must resuscitate womanhood.
Ooh.
And that's where we get the feminism point of view.
And as both someone who's now read and performed the play dozens and dozens of times and is performing in it a character, what do you get from the play specifically? What theme do you carry away from Mankind?
Okay, here it is. Here
Ooh,
it is.
Yeah.
And again, we cannot ignore the current body politic to explain this. What we are experiencing now is the final paroxysm of patriarchy. That's why Trump is in the White House right now, because this is the crumbling of an era that has lasted maybe a little over 2,000 years, where we all had to react to sacred masculinity. The historical pendulum has now swung 180 degrees, and what is on the horizon is sacred femininity.
Okay.
So, and what we see now are the guys freaking out.
And so that's why they elected Donald Trump, and that's why they like Steve Bannon and people like that. It's sort of this white male bastion last gasp, if you will.
Yeah.
Wow.
Right.
Before Oprah becomes president, essentially.
Yeah, this white male delusional gasp.
Do you think that Trump and the Republicans will be deposed in 2020? Or will it be another 4 years after that?
I don't think the Trump tribe will be deposed in 2020, because this isn't, just as we talked about adrenaline and sweetness and economy.
Yeah.
This is not something that's going to happen overnight. This is something that's going to happen gradually, because it is not those of us who currently wield the power who are going to make the change. It's going to be the people who see what the future might be if they allow those of us who only have ourselves invested. They know now they have to make the changes. So I think we call them millennials.
Well, yeah, but let me play devil's advocate here for a moment, if I may, and I may.
Thank you, Rabbi. Play the devil's advocate.
Oh, I shall indeed. So let's go back to the 1960s. Even when you first started acting, you would have figured that all these radicals, these socialists, these hippies, would have changed the world. They would have seen the male hegemony, the hierarchy, the masculinity, and said, nope, we're changing that, we're changing the rules, the haircuts, the clothes, women are equal, blah, blah, blah. What happened? We could have done this 60 years ago, 50 years ago.
No. We could not have done it 60 years ago. And, of course, I'm speaking with hindsight, retrospectively, because in my heart of hearts, I am an unreconstructed hippie.
Okay.
Those are the formative years of my life. I was part of the counterculture. My first professional show was Hair in Chicago, and we were a global community of young people who thought that we could change politics through love. And we sang seriously that song, "This is the Dawning of the Age of Aquarius." What we miscalculated was the term dawning.
Yeah.
That's why I began this conversation by talking about the era of patriarchy, or the age of patriarchy. Once you understand that an age is approximately 2,000 years, then to say in 1967, 68, those final summers of love, that this is the dawning of the age of Aquarius, means that now in the 21st century, we are on the threshold of the age of Aquarius.
So you're saying we have to wait until the 23rd century before things turn around?
No.
No, 23rd millennium, oi. 2,000 years, that's a long time, yeah.
No, but a year ago we were in the 20th century.
Well, yeah, oh, okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not a year ago, but if 2000, the century turned.
Right.
So those of us who were saying this is the dawning of the age of Aquarius in the 20th century simply miscalculated. We're now on the threshold of the age of Aquarius, and it is for the next generation, which we call millennials, to the other side.
I hope you're right. I do.
The age spectrum of millennials, we say, is from about 24 to 36 or something like that.
Now, let me ask you, André Deshields, since we're talking about change and people who aren't in the hegemony, shall we say, in the power positions. Well, you have been openly gay for many years. How many? At what point did you feel comfortable, or were you early on the curve? Were you out, shall we say, in the 1970s or early 80s?
Well, I was out when I was born.
Okay.
And because I'm 72, I lived at a time before the gay revolution, if you will. When I was growing up, the term gay still meant happy, carefree.
Right.
You only found that term in the American Songbook, in compositions
right.
That old poetry.
Glitter and be gay and all that, yes.
Yeah, and that sort of thing.
So
I grew up in a family of 11 children.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
I never had to make use of the opportunity of coming out of the closet, as we say, because my family knew exactly who I was, how I lived my life. When I brought my boyfriends to Baltimore, they were embraced by the family. When I brought my girlfriends to Baltimore, they were embraced by the family. So I never had to say, guess what, Mom and Dad? I'm homosexual. They knew.
Well, if you had girlfriends, you were bisexual, I assume.
Well, no. Well, oh. You know, I'm a black man. I grew up in the inner city in Baltimore. There's certain rites of passage you have to go through. So, as a young man, I had girlfriends.
Oh, okay. But they weren't, you know, beards or anything like that. You were just exploring, but it wasn't like you were using the women. Hmm?
Exactly, but that's what everyone does during their formative years. They explore to find out what it is that really makes their liver quiver.
Oh, okay.
All right.
But here's the deal. You grew up in Baltimore. Your family was very supportive. But then you went to school in Wisconsin, which I assume was not a thriving place for to be openly out. Or maybe it was.
But it was. Now, we're talking about the university. This is the beauty of it. This is the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the late 60s. It was one of the four hotbeds of political activism in the country.
Oh, okay.
Along with the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, Berkeley, and one might include
Columbia, maybe.
Well, one might include Columbia, but it was more of an intellectual revolution at Columbia. But in Wisconsin, we were shutting down the university.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, and that's when America was losing its veil, its political veil of innocence.
Right.
You know, all about the Vietnam War, all about the Dow chemical strikes, etc. All about divesting in diamond and coal mines in Africa, etc. And that's when I became of age. And that's when, before there were the doctrines of diversity and inclusion and multiculturalism, that's when there was a true sense of all life is indeed equal.
Hmm. Okay.
And I still carry that political position into my mature years.
We're talking with André Deshields here, the multi-talented actor, singer, dancer here in the neighborhood. And so we've gotten you from Wisconsin, now coming back to New York and being in this musical that was before my time called Warp. My God, what do you remember about that? Well, any memories about Warp? Yeah.
Absolutely. My first professional show was here in Chicago. I was working with the Organic Theater Company. We created the Organic Theater Company. We created the world's first episodic science fiction adventure.
Wow.
Which was called Warp. And this was 10 years before George Lucas and Star Wars. An enterprising entrepreneur picked up the show from Chicago and brought it to New York in 1973. And we were summarily dismissed by the New York critics as just a bunch of dirty, barefoot hippies from Chicago.
Mm.
But the show put me in New York, which is where I ultimately wanted to be. So when the company returned to Chicago, I decided, no, I'm going to make my stand here. Didn't have a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out of, but I did have some excellent comrades. And my salad days were very much like most young actors. I slept on the couch of a friend and traded that opportunity and kept her home for her while she was working in Jesus Christ Superstar. That was 1973.
Well, here's the deal. This is New York, and the acting profession picks you up and knocks you down. Picks you up. So your next Broadway show, or was to be a Broadway show, was something called Rachel Lily Rosenblum.
And don't you ever forget it.
That's actually the name of the show, yeah.
That was the title. It was written by Paul Jabara as a project for Bette Midler.
Oh.
But at the time, Bette Midler was, you know, becoming the divine Miss M.
Thanks to you, partially.
Partially. And,
let's say, what happened was she asked you for help with her backup singers, and... Yeah.
But let me finish this
story. Sure.
Because every time a window closes, another one opens. So, Bette Midler, for whom the show was written, passed on it, and it fell to Ellen Green to play the role of Rachel Lily Rosenblum. And as you know, Ellen Green launched her career with,
Little Shop of Horrors.
Of a Shop of Horrors, yes.
Yeah.
So although, as you say, this is an industry that knocks you down and picks you up and knocks you down again, it also is based on karma. What belongs to you is on its way to you.
And what was on its way to you after Rachel Lily Rosenblum was a little show called The Wiz, right?
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Arrived in New York in 1973, get summarily dismissed by the New York critics. 1 year later, I'm achieving a national profile.
Did it change? It certainly changed your professional life, but did you ever have that moment like, oh, I'm going to be rich, I'm going to be famous, did it go to your head at all, or you always kept your head?
No. It went to my heart more than it went to my head because again, I come from an era when we were reminded, whatever we do, whatever we say, wherever we go, we are representing the race. So when I had the opportunity to create the title role in The Wiz, I was doing it for my family first, and I was doing it for my nation second. The nation of African Americans.
So you wanted to make sure that it was a role that was decent and uplifting and role
and,
modeling.
And powerful and defiant and door opening. Because when I look back on how many other young black men have had an opportunity to play The Wiz because I created it. That's my satisfaction.
Cool. So.
And I look to the future as more opportunity.
Well, let me ask you about the future. Now that you are 72 and very, very well established, is it the point, do you still have to audition? Do you still have to go out there looking for things? Or does your agent just call and say, here are a couple of options, what you want to do for the next few months?
Well, I'm going to repeat my mantra.
Okay.
Some of what you say is absolutely correct. However, my perspective is, and I'm being repetitious.
Sure.
What belongs to me is on its way to me. What I have to do is not become distracted. How many times did our parents tell us not everything that glitters is gold?
Mm-mm.
What I believe and what I remind my young colleagues as often as I can, and I still think they don't hear it often enough, the universe is made for our pleasure. Think of it as a cornucopia spilling its abundance. There is enough for everybody. There's no such thing as inadequacy. There's no such thing as lack. There is enough for everybody. The problem is we spend so much time chasing blessings that have other people's names on it. When we don't receive it, we think that we must compete. No. What we have to do is pursue the blessings that have our names on it.
Well, yeah, but you can't tell in the pursuit which will or which won't. I mean, every actor that's what an audition is. You're pursuing a role and you don't know whether it has your name on it until the casting director says you're in callback.
Don't empower the casting director that way. I mean, there's definitely a network of the people in positions who make this industry work. However, the proof of whether you are on the right path is when the universe conspires to help you. It's not when the casting director conspires to help you. It's when the universe says, I'm going to help you. That's when you know you're on the right path.
Well, we are on the right path here talking with Andre DeShields. Remember that you can go see him now off Broadway in the comedy play Mankind at Playwrights Horizons. It's running through the end of the month off Broadway. Also, you're going sort of back in time and forward at the same time by directing one of the shows that made your name as a performer, Ain't Misbehavin'. You're doing that at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center the first week in February. What is that like, going back to a role you've played and then going to another actor and saying, okay, do this song?
Well, that is my gift. That's how I pay it forward. Because I can, as the source, I can put the actor who is now going to play Andre right where it all began. Think of it as passing the mantle. Also, there are very specific reasons for doing it now. NJ PAC wants to celebrate Black History Month, which is February, the shortest and coldest month of the year, but we could take that up later.
Okay.
And I want to, in my small way, celebrate the 40th anniversary of Ain't Misbehavin'. In 1988, the original cast, 100% of the original cast, came together and did the 10-year anniversary of Ain't Misbehavin' on Broadway. We were looking toward doing the 20th anniversary together, but Nell has gone to Hollywood. We were all doing different things. So we looked to the 30th anniversary, and Nell had died. So I'm thinking there's never going to be another opportunity for the original cast to come together and celebrate Ain't Misbehavin'. So what I need to do is take that treasure of information and give it to the next generation. So this is part of what we're doing at NJPAC.
Now
that's happening in February, but the 40th anniversary would have been in May.
This past May or next May? 1988. Yeah.
Yeah, May 2018.
Wow.
I'm saying all of that energy, all of that emotion, all of that sentiment, I'm investing in directing and choreographing a group of five tremendously talented people who are very much the same age that the original company was 40 years ago when we were doing it. For instance, the young man who's going to play Andre is 29. When I did Ain't Misbehavin', I was 30.
Huh. I get it.
Yeah, and I get chills even talking about it.
Well, yes, but here's what theater geeks want to know is, when will you be getting together the original anniversary cast of Primate, This is what people want. I'm kidding.
No. Okay. You know, Primate was a high point in my career. It was one of the most enlightening, entertaining, and ecstatic times that I've ever had on the stage. But we can't get the original company together again because the brilliant Phyllis Freilich,
that
great deaf actor from the West Coast, has since died.
I should explain to people who are not theater geeks that Primate was I did not see it, but apparently it was a very, not experimental play, but it was a play that took a lot of chances that a lot of the theater critics kind of wished that it didn't. It had to do with apes and the imitation of apes, and there was weird stuff on stage, but you're saying it was a great...
There was no weird stuff on stage, and it had nothing to do with imitating apes. What it had to do with was the relationship that we as primates have with other primates.
Okay. Yeah, I cannot speak to it because I did not see the play. I'm just saying that it was not a well accepted play, but it sounds like you had a fabulous time and got out of doing it.
It wasn't a well-reviewed play because many people come to the theater to have their current state of mind, political, emotional, and otherwise, confirmed. That is not what Primate was about. Theater must also challenge. Theater is tremendous opportunities to do effective storytelling. Not all stories are fairy tales.
Oh, for sure.
So this was holding a mirror up to society and looking at its blemishes, looking at its flaws. And some people are not comfortable with that. But as much as we love Shakespeare, that is exactly what he does. As a matter of fact, that is what young Hamlet challenges us to do. He says, you have to hold a mirror up to nature. You have to reflect society as it exists. And where you find the flaws, you have to tend to it. Where you find the wounds, you have to heal them.
Well, sure. I mean, and you can say that about any good play, though, is that it doesn't just confirm our innate feelings and stereotypes and what we already know going in.
But many times, plays and musicals simply serve to divert.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll tell you a show that you were in that the producer and the host of this radio program, Dave, saw on Broadway and found quite diverting, even though a lot of critics didn't appreciate it, was a show called Impressionism. He liked that show quite a bit. Do you remember? You remember that one. You were in it with Jeremy Irons.
Jeremy Irons and Joan Allen. And I got to play a Jewish baker.
There you go. So, any memories of working with Jeremy Irons and Joan Allen on that show? Any anecdotes? Any thoughts?
Yes. You hit on it early in this conversation, Rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
This industry, the litmus test of this industry, is that it guarantees two things, and it's not fame and fortune. It's rejection and insecurity. Now, here's the cautionary tale. If you are about to make a choice to enter this industry, you have to understand that you're going to be rejected on a daily basis. You're going to have to deal with insecurity, emotional, psychological, financial insecurity. So you're going to be hungry. If you can make rejection your meal, you're going to be lonely. If you can make insecurity your companion, then this is the path for you. But if you have any concern about those two challenges, then you need to be doing something else. And leave it to those of us who have chosen this profession, and likewise, the profession has chosen us. That's what I mean by the test is when the universe conspires to help you.
Well, we count ourselves lucky that you, André Deschilles, have chosen this profession, and it has chosen you, and that you have chosen to appear on this show. We want to remind folks that we can see you off-Broadway in Mankind, playing for the month of January off-Broadway at Playwrights Horizons. Also, go see your direction of Ain't Misbehavin' at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center from February 1st through the 4th. Our last question for you is that you've got a one-man autobiographical show that you do called Confessions of a, well, a Pimp. That's the name
no,
of
it. No.
Uh-oh. No what? No what?
It's called Confessions of a P-I-M-P. There's a period after every one of those initials, which means that it's an acronym.
For what?
Positive Individual Making Progress.
Okay. I was wondering how to pronounce that. So it's Confessions of a P-I-M-P, which you are certainly a positive individual. We haven't seen, you've done that in Chicago. When are you bringing that to New York, if at all?
Well, it takes time to create these pieces, and the first two-thirds of the show were created in New York at the Laurie Beachman Theater, which is downstairs of the West Bank Cafe.
Oh, yeah.
I finished the third in Chicago, which is when we had the first opportunity to put it all together. Now, to bring it to New York, which is what every producer has to face, requires a little more finances than I have right now. But it's not a lost cause.
Well, we certainly hope not. We certainly will come to Off-Broadway at the very least, and then you'll bring it back, and we can all, you know, you've told us just a smidgen about your biography. There's so much more, I am sure. Of course, we even invite you to come back on the program whenever you want to, because it's been a delight talking to André Deschilles here in the neighborhood. All we can wish you is further positivity, tons of more singing and dancing and acting and work and joy in your life.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Shalom to you.
Shalom.